some vitality of the inner spirits from the touch of Christ on us, and it is not an effort to just be religious. Sometimes the accoutrements of religion, the rituals and so forth, may give a good feeling, but I'm not sure that they always get into the nitty-gritty of where we live. See, we have to live on the earth. We live as families, and we have to confront human relationships constantly, day in and day out. And this is a good place to cement those relationships, where you have to interact with all ages, I should say, rather, and all temperaments and so forth. And we are not in a cloister here where we're sealed off from all those things. I think the greatest manifestation of the power of God is His ability to touch our spirits through the daily milieu and melee of life. The battle, the confusion, the chaos, the tragedy, all those things that make up our true lives. Sometimes people think they must get off to a mountain somewhere and be alone to get their spiritual input. But I think the greatest spiritual input comes to us in the power of Christ superseding our human situation. What that speaks to us is this, that there's no way you can counterfeit the work of the Spirit in us. You can counterfeit religion very easily. You can have all kinds of religious experiences. A lot of people found a great lift in the Olympic Games. One thing that demonstrated to me above all other experiences was that people can get stirred up even in situations that have nothing to do with Christ. You see, not that there was anything wrong with the Olympics or anything wrong with people's temperament, but to put it another way, stirred up feelings are no guarantee of the Spirit. Now, when you understand the difference between the psyche, which has to do with our emotions, and the Spirit, which has to do with our connection with God, when you understand that, you understand that many of the experiences that people have that they might brand as religious are really just soulish, or just psychical experiences. You can listen to music and get buoyed up a great deal. People can get ecstatic in a rock concert, or they can get ecstatic at a football game. That is not a guarantee of the Spirit, just because there's a lot of hype, as we might call it. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but people can get strong feelings that they may regard as religious, but they have not necessarily touched the inner spirit. To me, the proof of God is that we can come into a group like this and be in a natural context and be not surrounded by psychological symbols, and still the Spirit touches our inner being. We may not go out of here on air. On the other hand, we'll go out of here with our feet on the ground. It's better to have your identity with Christ in the milieu of daily experience than to have it in a cloistered context, which quickly fades away. Well, I don't want to get off on that. There are many things that can be said, but I want to get on with the text. The Bible is very clear on the idea that the inner spirit is God's area, God's arena, and that what He does inside our spirits is beyond our capacity to do. We do not buoy up our spirits by external religious feeling. But the buoying up of our spirits within may result in religious feelings of various kinds. Now, the book that we're looking at the present time is the book of Revelation. And we've gone through seven chapters of it. Now there's a passage today that goes along with that, and that is in chapter 8, and it has to do with prayer. Prayer is one of the instruments by which we relate to Christ. But in order to pray effectively, we have to understand the nature of Christ, which we've tried to do to a limited degree. Of course, we'll never as humans fully understand Him, but as far as possible, we've tried to understand the nature of Christ. We have to understand the nature of persons, per se. What is a person? And we have to understand the nature of the relationship between persons and God. And that's the sum and substance of our Christian experience, basically, of our ties to God. I think when we come to grips with those ideas, we clarify some muddy waters. Now, an incident in the panorama of the events that have to do with God's ultimate resolving of the earthly problem and the bringing in of His kingdom, we come to a seventh seal. When He opened the seventh seal, that is, this one who is one of the living creatures, is the agent in this, the expediter of this action. When He opened the seventh seal, there was silence in the heaven about a half an hour. Now, what that means in terms of time, I don't know. It's a symbolic number and not anything literal. I wouldn't think it was literal. It wouldn't make a whole lot of difference if there was only a half hour silent. But it has an impact here of a moment of hiatus. It's like a rest in music, I think. It's an emphasis of what is to come. That moment of silence emphasizes this next passage. And he said, and this is John speaking, of course, and I saw seven angels who stood before God, and to them was given seven trumpets. In a sense, the events of Revelation, which are kind of cataclysmic, many of them are, erupt like a skyrocket. You have a seven-sealed book, and out of the seventh seal comes another seven things, the seven trumpets. Out of the seventh trumpet comes seven vials. So it's like a skyrocket that blows up, and then you have another issue out of that group, and then another out of that one, a sequence. There's a seventh seal open now, and seven trumpets are going to sound. Now, there's a little parenthesis here. We interrupt the sequence of events with the seven seals. We come to another issue. It says, and another angel came and stood before the throne, or before the altar, having a golden censer, and to him was given much incense, that he may give it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense rose with the prayers of the saints out of the hand of the angel before God. And the angel took the incense, filled from it, out of it came the fire of sacrifice, and he cast it unto the earth. And there was thunder and noises, sounds and lightning and earthquakes. Now this is similar to the passage in chapter 5, which speaks of the prayers of the saints again. He says in verse 11, I saw and I heard a voice of many angels around the throne, the living creatures and the elders, and the number was 10,000 times 10,000. And I heard a great voice saying, blessing and honor and so forth. Oh, pardon me, it's a verse earlier than that. Verse 8. And when he took the book, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell before the Lamb, having each one of them a harp and golden vials full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. What we have here is, in symbolism, the ultimate implication or fulfillment of the prayers of the people of God on earth. It's very ethereal, sort of a thing, but I think it has some valid, clear symbolism. The Bible is replete with the idea of prayer. It's probably the sum and substance of the relationship of the individual to God. And you have it from Genesis to Revelation in all kinds of situations and all patterns and fashions and so forth. But the essence of prayer is communion with God, communication between the individual and God. Prayers are, in a sense, immortalized in this symbolism of Revelation. And you may have spent a great many hours in your lifespan praying. You may think that those prayers are scattered to the winds. You may, in your experience of prayer, have felt that you were praying to the ceiling or to the walls, and that prayer was sort of a religious exercise. For a lot of people, it's simply a process of genuflection. It's a posture of some kind. To many people, prayer is a routine, a symbolic routine of getting the attention of the divinity. So the priest, the lama in Tibet, turns his prayer wheel. And prayer for him is simply endless repetition of, pushing the button, as it were. Endlessly pushing the prayer button. With no personal interaction with it at all. Wherever prayer is an effort to prove to the deity the sincerity or piety of the prayer, the one who's praying, wherever that is true, prayer becomes merely a religious exercise of turning the prayer wheel. In Christian circles everywhere, it can be a very routine thing, just as much as the lama priest turning his prayer wheel. If we look upon prayer as a process by which we simply get the attention of the deity, or a process by which we get things from God, then it is nothing more than a celestial shopping trip. People are great shoppers, and I think for many people, prayer is bringing a shopping list to God. And so you just say, give me this and give me that. If we're really spiritual or pious, we may pause to say thank you occasionally. But generally, people think of prayer as coming to God to get something from Him, whatever it is. In that sense, prayer seems to be a finite, earthly kind of an exercise, and for that reason, people may think of it kind of in the terms of the local McDonald's process, where you drive up to the microphone and you give your order to the mic, and then you drive around and pick it up. There's no interaction much with the personnel. So we say our order into the microphone. Well, people praying in a room somewhere or wherever they are may feel like they're just giving their order in to the microphone. There's no interaction. Other people, on the other hand, seem to feel that prayer has got to bring some kind of dynamic response from God instantaneously. They feel that if they're really touching heaven, they're going to get celestial feelings of some kind, inner ebullience or something. If they don't get these things, they feel disappointed. Many meetings that you will go into here and there, the whole emphasis on let's hear from God, as though he has to communicate audibly or in some kind of a fleshly way. Now see, we come back to the point of the difference between spirit and flesh. If your prayer to God is a shopping trip and you want some kind of response from him that your brain can pick up on, then it can be a very disappointing exercise. But if you see prayer as a communion between the spirit of man and the spirit of God, a communion that is deeper than audible sounds, a communion that is more than shopping lists, a communion that is a sharing of one's deeper essence with God, if you see it that way, then you begin to open up the implications of what is being said here in the book of Revelation. God's communication with us goes far beyond our senses. That is, our physical senses. What you hear and feel and so on. What God does within your inner spirit may have little touch with your brain as such. It's in the brain that we not only seek for audible or physical experiences with God, but it's in the brain that we misunderstand the meaning of God. Whenever you try to let your brain articulate what God is all about in you, you begin to get into difficulty. Now, it is not that we should never have any sense of God, I don't mean that, but that viewing prayer as something that the mind works with brings it down to a mortal level. It's difficult to get hold of this because it's not something you can handle so much with the brain as you handle with the spirit. The implication of Revelation 8 is your communion with God becomes eternally ensconced, if I may say, in the atmosphere of heaven. Your communion with God becomes an eternally established thing in heaven. Where they are purely religious exercises, this will not be true. A prayer that is a religious exercise does go the way of the word, the wind, you see. But prayer that is a specific communion with God remains like energy in the heavens. You may think, as you've been perhaps praying for someone for a long time, especially persons, and you pray and pray day in and day out, and you don't see anything coming of it. This is where prayer becomes a problematical thing. Prayer is the most vital element of our relationship to God. And yet, it can seem so futile just to keep voicing words into the stratosphere, as it were. But if you see every prayer that you pray as an expression of your spirits, then you know that your prayer has great weight. Not so much in the mechanical moving of things, like praying for $1 million and not getting it, or praying for a lot lesser things and not getting them. Now, I spoke before of the nature of persons and the nature of God. And I've said to you that the essential nature of persons is spirits. All the rest of this is a vessel, cracked and broken and chipped. Your life on the earth involving your bodily activity is like a piece of pottery, a vase, a jug, filled with many inadequacies, inconsistencies, errors, faults, all of these things, a part of your earthly context. But the most real part of us is spirit. For the person who possesses the Spirit of Christ within that vessel, the important thing is not so much what happens to the vessel, but what happens to the spirit inside in response to what happens to the vessel. It isn't so much getting the vessel always patched up, as it is vital growth in the spirit as a result of the chips in the vessel. Your life with God is not a matter of having Him sort out all the pieces and make a nice life for you, and make you a nice vessel, and paint it all up outside, and plaster and everything else. Every time you get a chip in it, you run to the celestial artist to paint it out. That's not the issue. You, or the essence of things, is that you and I, as spirits, fundamentally spirit beings, live out our lives on the earth in these vessels, and wherever, whatever happens to the vessel enhances the spirit within, but our fundamental purpose is moving through the earthly scene triumphant over the vessel and developing in the spirit. You're running the gauntlet. You're not trying to reconstruct the gauntlet so it isn't as difficult. You're trying to get through the gauntlet. And in the midst of all the pressures and processes and distresses of life, your spirit remains strong. It is as though God has thrown you into the world to run the gauntlet as a spirit being. If people who don't get hold of the spirit factor simply run the gauntlet and stumble and fail and so forth, but without meaning. You run the gauntlet, but the meaning of your relationship to Christ is not smoothing out the gauntlet, but strengthening the spirit within in that process. You and He are in a union. When you pray, then, you may ask the Lord to remove the cup from you, as Jesus did. Before Calvary, when Jesus was praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, He prayed, "Father, if it be thy will, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt." That's the prayer you pray. "Lord, I need deliverance from this great problem, this distressing circumstance, this physical malady. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." Because you're running of the gauntlet in physical suffering, for example, or in privation of some kind, or in stress and tension and so forth. Your running of the gauntlet in that is in the name of Christ. Paul uses this very analogy in the Scriptures, being surrounded with so great a cloud of witnesses. "Let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who in exchange for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, counting of no value the shame," or of no account the shame, "and is now set down at the right hand of the Father on high." You are running the gauntlet in the name of Christ. If you think the race is of no value without a gold medal, you're missing the point of it. If you think that the gauntlet is unfair, you're missing the point. If the runners on the marathon had decided that they wanted to sit down under the shade of a tree and spend an hour drinking lemonade, if they felt their country ought to have provided that for them, they missed the point of the gauntlet, you see. But so often in Christendom, the word has seemed to be set forth that the essence of a viable faith is that we get things from God. So if you really have enough faith, he's going to replace the pavement with a grassy strip, so the race will be easier for you. We'll roll out a red carpet along the walk there. Your triumph will not be in succeeding in getting God to roll a carpet down the pavement. Your triumph will be finishing the race, and therefore before the eyes of Satan and his demons and the world of the godless and so forth, the person of the Spirit stands or runs the race well and finishes the race. In the prayer situation, and the prayer process, I should rather say, your great edge, advantage, is that while you are running the gauntlet, you have the inner communication between yourself and God. Your talking to Christ in prayer is not a means of getting things running, but a means of communion with him in the process. At the same time, there are other benefits. There is guidance when you need that, and there is a sense of understanding that you get about life and about things around you, and there are from time to time things the Lord does to help you in getting work or in getting housing or whatever it is. There are things the Lord helps you with. But I have to look at the great masses of humanity who live in circumstances far more penurious, far more distressful than ours. Washing machine that won't work, the automobile that has to get fixed, the flat tire, skimpy meal from time to time, and so forth. All these things that trouble us greatly. There are many, many parts of this world that can't even reach the level of our problems. They'd like to get up to the level of our distresses. But yet your distresses can be as heavy to you as to someone in a culture that has never had this kind of society. If you're dependent on electricity, you can't run out and put a paddle wheel in the local river, you know, as they can in Africa. So I really don't try to compare us in that sense. Just to say to us that the constant effort on the part of Christendom to focus our faith on getting things from God misses the essence of the meaning of prayer, which is an eternal interaction between our spirits and God's spirit, and it is in process while we were on the earth running the gauntlet. And his greatest gift to us is the capacity to stand firm in the midst of our human odyssey. That's his great gift to us. And our greatest sense of being and sense of life and reality is our realization that we are, in fact, part of God. We belong to him. He is our Father, and his country is our fatherland, and we're here on the earth as aliens, in a sense, running the gauntlet. So when you pray, don't come with the spirit of, I've got to have this, and I've got to have that. Why don't you do this, and why don't you do that? Talk to him or commune with him about your problem. Commune with him about the stress in your life. Commune with him about the relationships that are going awry. Ask for help in getting work or help in whatever you do. But leave it with him. Express your need and leave it there. Don't make the fulfillment of your wish the test of your faith. Don't ever do that. Don't say, well, if I really believed God, he'd give me this thing or give me that. Don't ever do that. Just commune with him. Come and enjoy the communion and interaction between yourself and him. Father, we ask you to help our minds to, or our spirits to grasp the truth of these things today. It's not easy. to get hold of these things, but we ask that the Spirit will make real to us their meaning. In Christ's name, amen.